All right, I guess this is a good time as any to get started, and people will be able to catch up as they call in. So I want to thank everybody who's listening now or listening later. I want to thank you for calling in today or tuning in when we set this up online. I am Dave Johnson. I'm a senior fellow with Campaign for America's Future, and you can find us online at ourfuture.org. That's O-U-R. On today's call, we're going to be talking about something that most people are not very much aware of, and that's our trade deficit, what it means, what caused it, and what we can do about it. Joining us today will be Dean Baker. Dean's an economist, and he's co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Clyde Prestwitz of the Economic Strategy Institute. After their comments, we'll be open up to questions and answers. But first, Campaign for America's Future holds regular calls like this. It's a regular series where we're discussing manufacturing and trade issues. We have a low traffic announcement listserv, so it only puts out announcements of these calls and other important events. So it's not a high traffic listserv, so you don't need to worry about joining it. And to join it, you can email me at djohnson@ourfuture.org. So let me set the stage for today's call. The trade deficit has been overshadowed by all the scare stories about the budget deficit. But here's the thing. The policies that result from scare stories about the budget deficit tend to hurt working people and help the wealthiest few. On the other hand, there is very little discussion of our trade deficit. People don't even tend to know that we have one or what it means. Yet policies that would result if people were aware of this problem would tend to help working people in our economy and, ironically, would help bring down the budget deficit. People generally sense that something is going on with our trade policies. Mention NAFTA to almost any demographic and they will say it cost us jobs and helped wipe out entire communities and regions of the country. Here's why. Imagine if companies that make or do things inside the U.S. had received $400 to $500 billion in new orders last year, and again this year, and again next year. Picture what that would do for jobs in our economy. Factories reopening, businesses opening, suppliers booming. That is a quick metric to use to measure what the trade deficit has been doing to our economy. So what is the trade deficit? Why do we have it? What harm is it doing, and what can we do about it? Joining us first is Clyde Prestwitz, founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. Clyde formerly served as counselor to the Secretary of Commerce in the Reagan administration. He has served as vice chairman of the President's Committee on Trade and Investment in the Pacific and sits on the Intel Policy Advisory Board and the U.S. Export-Import Bank Advisory Board. Clyde regularly writes for leading publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, Fortune, and Foreign Affairs. Clyde, thank you for joining the call.
And my pleasure, Dave.
I
had to chuckle with listening to you make your introduction because I remember first becoming engaged with the trade deficit in 1981 when I showed up for my first day of work at the Commerce Department as counselor to the Secretary of Commerce, Mack Baldridge, in the Reagan administration. And Mack, I walked in and I said to Mack, what's my job? And he said, Clyde, your job is to reduce the trade deficit. And in 1981, the trade deficit was $25 billion annually, and it was becoming a concern. And I said to Baldridge, well, you know, will I get paid for this? And he gave me some number, which I forget what it was, but it was less than my wife and kids had become accustomed to. And I pointed it out to him, and he said, not to worry, he was a businessman. The Commerce Department would pay me a bonus, 10% of the amount by which I reduced the trade deficit. So by 1985, trade deficit was $150 billion annually. I owed Baldridge $15 billion. And I had to start thinking about how do I really get this trade deficit under control. But anyhow, you asked the question, what is the trade deficit? And it's pretty simple. It means that American imports exceed exports. It means that Americans are consuming more than they are producing. And of course, if you are buying more than you're selling, you got to pay for it. And typically you pay for it by borrowing. And that's what the United States does. So this year, our trade deficit will be on the order of somewhere between 2.7 and 3% of GDP. And we'll borrow that amount typically from Japan, China, are our major funders to keep that going. And because we are not at full employment in the U.S., that trade deficit, as you pointed out, the fact that we have that trade deficit and we do not have full employment means that the deficit is resulting in higher unemployment. If we could reduce the deficit by selling more, making more, selling more, and providing more services and importing less, we would create jobs. And recently I did a calculation, just rough back of the envelope thing, but essentially if we had balanced trade, we would gain something in the order of 5 or 6 million jobs in the U.S., which would cut our unemployment dramatically. Why is it that we buy more than we sell? And there are a lot of complicated reasons. One of them is that we're a low-saving society. We run our economy with a very high level of domestic consumption. Domestic consumption is, I've forgotten the numbers exactly, but it's something on the order of 76 or 77% of our GDP. Compare that to a country like Germany or Japan, where the consumption of percent of GDP would be somewhere in the high 60s or low 70s. So we don't save. We consume a lot. We, of course, defend the world, so we're spending more on defense and international affairs, about 4 or 5% of GDP, than compared to other countries. Typically, our allies are spending 1 or 2% of GDP. And then a second major factor is that the global trading system has been constructed over the past 60 or 70 years, in terms of America being the great source of demand and the rest of the world being a source of supply. So countries like Japan began it right after the war in the 1950s, 1960s. Japan had a catch-up strategy. Export-led growth was the way it aimed to get to grow rapidly. Japan went through a period of 20 years of 10% per year annual GDP growth, and it did that by restricting imports, by enforced high savings rates, by subsidizing exports, maintaining an undervalued currency, doing everything it could to promote exports. And why do that? Because Japan wanted to be in industries characterized by high degrees of economies of scale, which yielded high productivity, and that's how you get rich. The Japanese domestic market was not big enough to give the economy world-class economies of scale, so to get economies of scale, they had to export, and the strategy was then to high savings, high investment, high exports, mostly to the U.S. Korea copied that. Lee Kuan Yew down in Singapore famously said, look east, and his advice to Singapore and other economists. Korea, Taiwan, and now China have all copied that strategy. Germany always had it. And so the world trading system has been constructed around a division of labor in which the labor of the U.S. is to consume and the labor of much of the rest of the world is to save, invest, produce, and export to the U.S. Let me stop there, and we can carry on with further Q&A.
Well, thank you, Clyde. Can you tell listeners the best place to go to find your work?
Well, Amazon is a great place. The ESI website, econstrat.org, has most of it there. Foreign Policy Magazine. I blog for Foreign Policy Magazine, so a lot of my writing is on Foreign Policy website.
Great, thanks. Next, I'd like to introduce Dean Baker. Dean is co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR. Dean is frequently cited in economics reporting in major media outlets, including New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, CNBC. Dean, I take CNN off that list. I hear they're moving to a print output. That's a joke. He writes a weekly column for The Guardian Unlimited, The Huffington Post, Truthout, and his blog, Beat the Press, features commentary on economic reporting. I think I saw you last week on the PBS NewsHour. Dean has recently co-written the book Getting Back to Full Employment, A Better Bargain for Working People, along with Jared Bernstein, who is chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. Dean and Jared published an op-ed in the New York Times, I think it was last October. It was titled Taking Aim at the Wrong Deficit, that helped drive awareness of this problem. So Dean, welcome, and tell us a little bit about this problem and what we can do about it. Dean, are you still here? Clyde, are you here?
I'm here.
Did I lose everybody? Dean, what happened? Are you here? You were here earlier. Okay, hold on. I think I know what it is. I think possibly. Keep trying.
Unmuted.
Okay, all callers are unmuted. Dean, are you here now?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear music from somebody, too.
Not me.
All right, I'll tell you what. I'm going to go back to the mute, and then Dean hit star six. I think
okay.
You called in on the caller line.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Good, Dean.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. You can listen to someone who can't figure out how to work a phone. Okay, so what
it's
I want
hard.
To do
is, it's hard to do.
Yeah, I know. This is really difficult stuff. That's why we have a trade deficit. I want to make three main points, largely along similar lines to what Clyde had said. First, just to emphasize the importance of the trade deficit in terms of macroeconomics. This is an accounting identity. This isn't the sort of thing any of us should be arguing over. It's an accounting identity. I once went through this with a reporter who I won't mention the person's name, but afterwards he said, I don't like accounting identities. You know, that's fine. You're welcome to like them or not like them, but they're true. There's no way around them. So I just want to talk about trade deficit as being part of our unemployment gap, the fact we're below full employment levels of output. Secondly, just, you know, emphasizing this point, how important it is to close this gap, how important it is to get full employment, particularly through trade, because this, it's not just creating jobs, it's about raising wages, and this is the main point of Jared and my book on full employment. And the last point, it's not hard. The dollar is really central in this story. If we get the dollar down, we could get the trade deficit down. We got a big trade deficit because the dollar went up. We need to get the dollar down. And, you know, I was talking about this a couple weeks ago, and someone was talking to me like I'm a big protectionist. I'm going, this is the standard mainstream theory. You know, Fred Bergstrom, who's as big a free trader as you'll find anywhere, probably agrees with me, you know, 80 or 90% of the way on this. I don't know if it's 100%. I'll allow some difference there. But he basically agrees with this story. So I'm not, this isn't, we could argue about whether we should be protectionist or not, but this isn't protectionism. It's really free trade. The first point, again, Clyde made this, if we're spending, we have a trade deficit of $500 billion a year, that's money that's going abroad, income that's generated in the United States, creating demand in Canada and China and Mexico, wherever it might be, it's not creating demand here. That creates a big demand gap. How do you fill the gap? It's very simple. There's two ways, and this is just definitional. One, you could have a large budget deficit. I'm not particularly scared of budget deficits, but we know those aren't really popular among politicians, so we don't run deficits, or at least as large deficits we need to generate full employment. So that's out. You know, we could have a bigger deficit. You know, we could argue whether that'd be a good thing or a bad thing. Not going to happen, though. I don't see a lot of people, President Obama, you know, the Democrats aren't for it, the Republicans aren't for it. So we're not going to get to full employment with a bigger budget deficit. Okay, how else can you do it? Well, you could do it through a big deficit on the private side. Private sector, we could have negative savings on the private side. Well, we did that. Some of you might remember all the way back to 2005, 2006, 2007, we had a really big housing bubble. That gave us negative savings on the private side. We had you know, massive investment in residential construction, the biggest we'd really seen ever. And then on top of that, because people had so much equity in their house, they weren't saving, they were spending, they were consuming. So that gave us a deficit on the private side. Well, that got us to full employment in 2005, 6, 2007. But obviously it wasn't very stable, and I don't think anyone in their right mind would want to get back to that story. So basically, there really isn't a way around this picture that if we have a large trade deficit and we want to get to full employment, well, your choices are one, a big budget deficit, or two, basically bubble-driven growth. We could do either, but both of them sound pretty bad to at least a lot of people. The second sounds much worse to me than the first, but in any case, those are our options. So that's why, you know, I would argue very strongly that if we want to get back to full employment, we really do have to talk about getting the trade deficit down, basically because there isn't another route to fill that gap. If we have a trade deficit of 3% of GDP, $500 billion, we don't have another route to fill the gap. Okay, a second point on the importance of it for the economy. Again, I've come up with the same numbers as Claude. I've beaten it up. I don't think you get any very different numbers. If you say we snapped our fingers tomorrow, we balanced the trade deficit, we had balance instead of the deficit, it creates over 4 million jobs directly. You take indirect employment somewhere around 6 million with a multiplier. So it's a big impact. That gets us pretty close to full employment. Whether we still want to go further or not, you know, we can quibble, but if we create 6 million jobs, we're pretty close to full employment. So that's a really big deal. But on top of that, these will generally be better-paying jobs. Manufacturing continues to be a source of relatively good-paying jobs for the 70% of the workforce that doesn't have a college degree. And this is something that is now pretty widely accepted in the profession. David Auder, who I think most people have probably heard of him, the MIT economist, who's written a great deal on technology and inequality. He's also written on trade and inequality, and he's fairly clear on this, that he sees trade, the loss of manufacturing jobs, as a major factor in increasing inequality over the last 10 or 15 years. So, again, I'm not going to say every economist agrees on this, but, you know, Auder, I think, is very much in the center, a prominent mainstream economist, has argued strongly for this position. I think it's growing in its acceptance. Now, on top of that, we get to the argument that Jared and I were making about the importance of full employment. The circumstances under which most workers have been able to see wage gains in the last three decades has been when the economy has been near full employment. In particular, we were struck at the period at the end of the 1990s when we got the unemployment rate down to levels that most economists didn't think was previously possible. In the early 90s, mid-90s, it was pretty widely held that 6% was a floor, 6% or thereabout was a floor on the unemployment rate. If it got below that, that we would have serious problems with inflation. Well, of course, late 90s, we got under 5%, we got under 4.5%, and then eventually as a year-round average, we had 4% unemployment for the year 2000. And Jared and I have looked at this closely, and we see that you saw wage growth up and down the income ladder, and particularly at the bottom, say, 20, 30% of the wage distribution. This is the first time, the only time, since the early 70s, that workers at the middle and the bottom end of the wage distribution have shared in the gains of productivity growth. So that to us was a very strong lesson, very important lesson. And again, the takeaway for us is that we have to get back to low rates of unemployment. There's a huge distributional impact there. Basically, we'll see upward redistribution of income absent something like full employment. And if we can get back to somewhere around 4% unemployment, that will have a huge difference, again, not just getting people jobs, but allowing them to have higher wages. And again, reducing the trade deficit is the best, most sustainable way we could see to do that. The last point is it's not a great mystery. If you look at the history of our trade deficit, it very strongly follows movements in the value of the dollar. And, of course, this is, you know, the econ we teach in Econ 101, that when the dollar goes up, our goods become more expensive to people living overseas. Imports become relatively cheaper to those of us here in the United States. That's why Clyde was talking about how the trade deficit soared back in the mid-80s. Well, the dollar soared. That's why the trade deficit soared. Dollar fell at the end of the 80s. It was actually negotiated. We negotiated the Plaza Accords. I forget whether it was 86 or 87. The dollar fell by 20 to 30% against our major trading partners at the time. The trade deficit fell to roughly 1% of GDP. It stayed around 1% of GDP till the late 90s. The key incident here was the East Asian financial crisis in 1997, Following that bailout, I won't go into details here, but following that bailout, we saw a soaring dollar against most major currencies. And the result of that was our trade deficit exploded. It went from a little over 1% of GDP to a peak of 6% of GDP back in 2006. Now, the dollar has given up some of those gains, and the non-oil trade deficit has fallen somewhat, but it has to fall further. So the basic story is that if we want to get the trade deficit down, we have to get the dollar down. It's not a matter of hocus-pocus or, you know, what could we do? Basically, we know we have countries, China's the biggest, but it's not the only one. We have countries that are deliberately propping up the dollar against their own currencies to preserve their export markets. It's a question of sitting down, negotiating with these countries. We don't have to take a club to their heads, but we negotiate with them all the time. And we have to say, the priority is we need to get the dollar down against your currencies. It means we'll give up some other things. But we could do that. The question is making a political priority. So long and short, what I'd say is that the trade deficit is an enormous economic problem. It deserves a hell of a lot more attention than our budget deficits do. And we have an easy enough remedy. It's getting the dollar down, and that's something that is within our ability to do. It's a political question. It's really not an economic one. So I'll stop with that.
All right, Dean, thanks. Can you tell us where to find book info online and the best place to go to find your other work?
People can get the book on our website. It's you can download for free. You could also get copies, hard copies, at Amazon for the book. And all of my work's on our website, www.cepr.net.
Thanks, Dean. I'm going to open the line for questions. To ask a question, press star 6. That will unmute yourself, and then just ask the question. There's no moderator with a cue or anything, so you might want to take turns. We'll see how that works. And while we wait for people to find star 6 on their phones, I have a quick question. Most people now, and I'm sure a lot of people on this call, are aware of this issue because of the publicity around upcoming trade deals and fast track. And that has caused a lot of organizations to do reports, et cetera, on what the past trade deals have done and the effect of that. NAFTA, the trade deficit, China, the trade deficit, huge trade deficit with China. So I have a couple quick questions if you want to address it. Trans-Pacific Partnership is not addressing currency, from what we understand, and what can we do about that? And a second question, if you can address it while we wait for other questions, does fixing trade have to mean that working people in other countries lose their jobs or face lower wages? Want to take that on?
Yeah,
sure.
I'll start and Quad can jump in. I mean, I'm not a fan of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I don't really see it as being about trade. I think that's very much a misnomer. It's about regulations, and one could argue whether they're good or bad. I think a lot are clearly bad, in my view. Most importantly, stronger patent protections for drugs. They'll raise drug prices everywhere. Not a good story. But it really has very little to do with trade. In terms of, you know, whether workers in other countries have to pay, have lower wages, in China, they're concerned with labor shortages. You know, there's an article just last week about workers at an IBM plant are on strike getting large wage gains. They don't have a problem with shortfall in demand right now. We do. So I don't think it's a question that, you know, we're asking that their workers suffer so our workers can prosper. I don't think there's a reason their workers can't continue to see large wage gains as they have over the last decade.
Well, I think it's kind of the reverse in a way. It's not that their workers might suffer. What's happening right now is our workers are suffering as a result of the structure of the trade and the fact that Chinese policies are aimed at keeping the currency undervalued and aimed at promoting exports to the U.S. that are subsidized in one way or another. So, I think it's important for the U.S., actually, to be taking steps to offset some of this negative impact on U.S. workers. I agree with Dean, the TPP, it's, I like to say it's not about trade, it's not about partnership, and I guess it's in the Pacific, but, there's a tendency, has been for a long time, for anything called free trade to be seen as positive, and that's just not simply the case. I mean, we know from previous experience, I have to laugh, I go back looking at some of the transcripts of hearings in the early 2000s when the issue was whether China would join the WTO. And our trade officials, the trade representative, the Secretary of Commerce, other leading officials and business people, and virtually all of the Washington think tanks went up to the Congress and testified and said that bringing China into the World Trade Organization would reduce our trade deficit with China because China had more barriers than we do. And so in any trade deal, China would have to disproportionately reduce its barriers, and American exports would flood to China, and our trade deficit would vanish. Well, at that time, our trade deficit with China was about $50 billion a year. Since China came into the WTO, it's grown to over $300 billion a year. So, you know, these forecasts that typically accompany these campaigns to pass new trade deals are worse than useless. And in the case of the TPP, I think that almost inevitably, as it is currently structured, it would result in higher unemployment and declining wages in the U.S.
Okay, so if you have questions and you have hit star 6, I think if you hit star 6 again, you might get muted again. So anybody out there with a question, go ahead.
This is Barbara Whitestack. Can you hear me?
We can.
Yes.
Okay, good. I'm sorry if this sounds really naive, but I have never understood how the system works so that the United States as a country owes money when there's a trade deficit. So if I go and purchase a foreign car, a car that's made in Japan, here in the United States, and that causes a $30,000 trade deficit, I've paid $30,000 in cash, and somebody gives that to whoever, Nissan. How comes the United States gets involved in that?
Well, the United States doesn't get involved in the transaction, but
right.
when you bought the car, you sent $30,000 to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But the Japanese, nobody in Japan bought an American car.
Mm-hmm.
Or bought anything else for which they paid $30,000. So you sent $30,000 to Japan, and Japan didn't send anything here.
Uh-huh.
And so that means that the United States, if our trade consisted of that single transaction, then the U.S. would have a trade deficit of $30,000. And so how do we pay for that $30,000? The best way to pay for it is if we made, a Jeep Cherokee, let's say, and sent it to Japan, and somebody in Japan bought a Jeep Cherokee for $30,000. And then that transaction would offset your transaction, and the countries would be even.
Mm-hmm.
But Japan's not buying Jeep Cherokees, and so the transaction's not even. It's unbalanced in favor of Japan, and we borrow money then to you probably took a mortgage or you've took a car loan or something to pay for that car. Does that make sense?
Or maybe you were building Jeep Cherokees, and that's how you got to pay for the car, and now your job's gone because they didn't buy
yeah.
one.
Right,
but so effectively – the United States kind of has to get its $30,000 back from Japan.
Or someplace else.
It
has to get $30,000 back.
So it kind of has to give Japan $30,000.
Well, oftentimes what will happen is, in fact, quite often the current context, they'll end up buying up U.S. assets. Oftentimes it's U.S. government bonds, but sometimes, you know, they'll buy up shares of stock. I mean, depending whose hands the money ends up in. If it ends up in, you know, Toyota's hand, you know, they may say, okay, we're going to invest that in a factory, you know, which obviously they've done to some extent. But it will end up coming back here in some form or other. We would most like to see it. You know, as Claude said, it'd be great if they bought a car or whatever. They bought something we produced, but more often they're buying bonds, they're buying some financial asset.
more questions or follow-up?
Yeah, this is Lauren Steiner. Can you hear me?
Yes,
yep.
We can hear you.
Okay, so Alan Grayson on the call, the TPP National Planning call a couple of weeks ago, said that China owns about $6 trillion of our U.S. Treasury bills and bonds, and he says the total asset value of the United States is $60 trillion. So if it keeps going at this pace of $300 billion a year, they could own us in, like, you know, 15, 20 years, and that would be accelerated if the TPP is passed. I wanted to know if you guys thought that was accurate. And second of all, why do U.S. corporations not care about this? Is it that they're making up the difference selling their products to every other country but the United States?
I haven't heard that. You can go first, Clyde.
Yeah, go ahead.
Or yours, Clyde.
Oh, no, I was going to say, at the end, corporations don't care too much about this. As you know, they're selling in all the markets, actually, many corporations are benefiting enormously. They're being subsidized to put factories, say, in China. They get tax breaks, they get free land, they get free infrastructure if they put a factory in China. Paul Ottolini from Intel, for example, has said publicly that as a result of these various subsidies and benefits, Intel is saving about $1 billion a year on producing chips in China rather than in the U.S. So, you know, Intel makes money whether they produce the chips in China or produce them in the U.S., and they get some benefit out of the current Chinese regime by producing them in China. So they don't care too much. You know, people who care are workers in the U.S., just to stay with the semiconductor analogy. Intel produces a lot of its chips in New Mexico and Arizona. So if an Intel plant that goes to China means it's an Intel plant that didn't go to New Mexico or Arizona. So, you know, people, workers and officials and people living in New Mexico and Arizona get hurt because they're not getting the jobs that they otherwise might have gotten.
I'll just throw in a couple things there. First off, in terms of the numbers, I hadn't heard $6 trillion. I think it's somewhere closer to 2, although I have to say I haven't looked at the numbers.
I think about 3, actually.
But anyhow, I'm not that worried that we're all going to, China's going, you know, because we are still growing, too. So they're not about to own the whole U.S., at least not anytime soon. But the other part of the story, and just, you know, again, picking up on Claude's point, perhaps pressing it a little further, I think it's wrong to see these companies as U.S. companies. They say this as clearly as possible. Intel, General Electric, they're there to make a profit. If they could do that by investing in the United States, they're happy to do that. If they're going to make more money investing in China, that's what they're going to do. And they've been telling us that. You know, I don't know why anyone at this point would doubt this. I mean,
yeah,
they say
yeah.
that. They're as clear as they could possibly be. They're going to invest wherever they'll have the greatest profit. And that often can mean the direct opposite, because I was talking a moment ago about the importance of raising the value of the dollar. Well, if you're Walmart, you put a lot of effort in getting low-cost supply chains, getting things from Bangladesh and from China and Vietnam and Cambodia. You've put a lot of effort into that, and that's one of the ways you undercut your competitors. They're not anxious to see the dollar fall against those currencies and suddenly lose their competitive advantage. Same applies if General Electric just set up a manufacturing operation in China. They don't want to see a Chinese currency rise by 20% and lose that edge. So they're actually on the other side of this. They're not worried about the trade deficit. That's not their concern. You go to the head of GE and say, hey, what about the trade deficit? Yeah, maybe I'll have a conversation with you, but that's not his concern as head of GE. You know, so I think it's important to understand. They're there to make a profit. They say that as clear as they possibly could. So I'm not saying a bad thing about them. That's what they're in business for. It's just, you know, wolves eat the elk, you know. Is that bad? That's what wolves do. Companies try to make a profit.
Okay, well, can I ask a follow-up to that question? So the whole idea of a free trade agreement is that we're supposed to drop all the subsidies. So with NAFTA, they made Mexico drop the protection for the corn, and then we flooded, we didn't stop subsidizing our corn, and we flooded their market with free corn, causing all their farmers to go out of business and come up here for jobs. So how come in these free trade agreements, well, I guess we don't have one with China, but, you know, that they get to subsidize American factories over there. I mean, these are not free trade. I mean, not
well,
only
is,
do they
no,
not
no, these
with,
are, yeah, I think your point is that these are not what we, you know, we call them free trade agreements, but they're really not. They're about managing trade. And typically they don't deal with the main drivers of trade. So for example, the current TPP that's being negotiated isn't dealing with the currency question, which as Dean pointed out is the key question. TPP won't deal with that, so whether you have a TPP or not, countries will manage their currencies in order to facilitate their exports. Another thing that the TPP doesn't deal with are these investment incentives. So, I mean, just to come back to the semiconductor analogy, it's not on an operating, straight-out operating cost basis, it's not less expensive to make a semiconductor in China than in the U.S. These are not labor-intensive products. They're technology and capital-intensive. And so it's actually less expensive on straight operating costs to make those things in the U.S. But what happens is that because of the free land and the cut-rate utilities and the training of labor and other investment incentives that are provided by China and other countries, Singapore does it, Ireland does it, France does it, many countries provide these incentives, and these incentives then tend to drive where the investment and production takes place. And by doing that, they change the pattern of trade. Those things are not at all being covered in any of these so-called free trade negotiations, yet they are the biggest determiners of trade.
Next question. If you're trying to ask a question, we can't hear you.
Oh.
You need to hit star 6 to unmute yourself, by the way. I heard
this
some.
This is Michael Spacco. Can you hear me?
I hear you.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Forgive me if this has already been addressed. I didn't get the first part of the conference. I have a question specifically about some of the food safety provisions in the TPP. Now, I don't know if you know some of these because they're top secret, but I'd like to know what it is that your understanding of what it might be. My understanding is there's going to be something in there that will talk about lowering overall food safety standards, and that with the possibility of saying that other countries will have substantially equivalent food safety to, for example, to the U.S., and that because of that, it will allow them to, for example, ship food into the U.S. that doesn't have to go through USDA or FDA inspections. Now, am I correct in those potential assumptions of what it is that's going to happen?
I think Clyde addressed that earlier, right, Clyde, of regulation?
Well, I didn't really deal with it on the food thing, and I don't really know. I mean, part of the problem, as the questioner pointed out, is that these negotiations are secret, so you have cleared advisors from the industry who are privy to what's actually being negotiated, and the rest of us kind of guess or get leaks. And I'm not, I have to say, completely up to date on where it stands specifically with the food and agricultural items. I know generally that there's a concern that the TPP would enable overriding of U.S. standards, so that because of the TPP agreement, a country wouldn't necessarily have to adhere strictly to U.S. standards, but would adhere to some other standard, and then if there's a dispute, it goes to an international dispute resolution body. And so the concern that I've heard raised is that you could get around the FDA by going through the international dispute resolution process.
Right.
Okay, because what I'm looking at is the people who are in one of the major food corporations in the United States would look at this and say, wow, this is a great way for us to, for example, sell potatoes to Japan that Japan now bans because it has the U.S. potatoes has a higher uses a pesticide that they don't accept, and that also we could get Japan to lower their food safety standards on beef, and that they would say, oh, this is great, we can sell more beef and potatoes. What I'm wondering is, does this mean that if, you know, that gets agreed, it also means that Vietnam can sell more pesticide-laden shrimp and catfish, and Australia can send in more beef that is contaminated with a higher level of perhaps E. coli because they don't have those.
That's right. So, do you have another question?
Yeah, well, my question is there a way for us to have any other kind of insight into what's happening with this specific area without having it leaked through WikiLeaks? I mean, that's the
I don't think there is a way, and this is, again, one of the big problems. I just thought, to my mind, sort of amazing that, we have to have, like, a top-secret trade negotiation here and hope that, a third party, WikiLeaks in this case, will somehow get us, an advanced version before it's final. Because obviously the intention, and I don't think there's anyone really would dispute that, the intention is to drop this thing as a package. They're pushing for fast track, or I'm forgetting the new term for it, but whatever, fast track approval. They'll drop it on Congress. There'll be very limited time for anyone to look at it. And, they're going to get all their corporate interest out there, with all their money. They'll have, Washington Post will have near hysterical editorials in their news section calling anyone who doesn't support it a protectionist Neanderthal. There'll be enormous pressure on Congress to approve it. And, I just don't – if you're having a serious discussion on trade policies, these are debatable issues. I'm no expert on food safety. I don't know the best way to do it. But, the idea we're just going to – we spent a lot of effort building up our food safety laws over the years. They're far from perfect for sure. But to just say, okay, here it is, new laws, these are the deal, you got 30 days or whatever, take it or leave it, that's kind of incredible.
Who imposes the secrecy?
Well, I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions here. Because
the secrecy is imposed by the White House, by the U.S. Trade Representative's office, which designates a group of people that to whom it will talk, and that they're designated as advisors. And the group includes a large number of CEOs of multinational companies. There are some labor leaders. There are some think tank analysts included in the group. There's about 600 total people, and they have privileged access to the transcripts and the records of debate and negotiation. But even Congress, members of Congress, cannot get access to most of this material. And as Dean said, the rest of us depend on WikiLeaks and reading between the lines. Now, the argument is that it's very difficult to negotiate these deals in public because it inhibits give and take and makes flexibility kind of vanishes because everything's in public, and so people can't afford to be seen to be turning around from something that they said earlier. And there's some truth in that. Having been a negotiator myself, I know that it is difficult to negotiate in public. But on the other hand, I think that a lot of this is, as Dean said, it's tactical. You keep everything secret until the last minute and then roll out your big propaganda guns and try to push it through Congress by brute force.
Yeah. Well, I think we have time for one, maybe two short questions if everybody's willing to stay on for another minute. So remember, if we don't hear you, you've got to hit *6 to unmute yourself.
Can you hear me, Dave?
We can hear you.
Isaiah Poolar, future.org. I'm interested in knowing the balance between how much of the solution lies in currency and in the United States weakening its dollar as opposed to a lot of the other solutions that we have been talking about a lot more in terms of the United States having its own industrial policy, its own measures for supporting manufacturing. I'd like to know what's the balance there.
Well, I'll jump in on that. I think the dollar is huge. I mean, which isn't to say we can't and shouldn't be doing a lot of other things. But, you know, you look in the 80s, you know, the trade deficit exploded in the mid-80s, early mid-80s, as the dollar rose. We negotiated the Plaza Accord in, I think it was 86, might have been 87. But in any case, the dollar, we had an orderly decline in the dollar over the next 2 or 3 years. Trade deficit fell a lot. We stayed with relatively low trade deficits into the mid-late 90s, and then, you know, again, the dollar exploded following the East Asian financial crisis. Trade deficit followed. We've gotten the trade deficit down a fair bit. The non-oil deficit is probably the better one to focus on. It's fallen by close to half, maybe even a little more, since its peak in 2006, again, following very closely on the dollar. So I really see that as central, which, you know, again, doesn't mean that I think it's the only thing we can and should be doing. But I just think it dwarfs almost everything else.
I think I agree with that. I think that a lot of these things go together. You know, if you look at the strategy and policies of China or Korea, Taiwan, whoever it is, you know, they're playing with their currency, and they're also offering investment incentives to induce investment into their national regions. They're tweaking the regulations as best they can to favor domestic production. It's a package. And, you know, what we've just never been able to do is to apply the same kind of strategic thinking to our economic policies that we do to our geopolitical policies.
One more question?
Yeah, this is Lauren Steiner again. My understanding is that the new Democrats are going to be the ones pushing for a kinder, gentler fast-track bill. Wondering if you guys want to make an appointment to meet with their caucus, because a lot of them are younger, and they may not have this education that you provided.
Well, I'd be happy to.
Yeah, me too. If they want to talk to me, I'm happy to talk to them.
Sure.
And I think, Clyde, are you in D.C.?
I am right now, yeah.
Okay, yeah, so they're available for that. Okay, well, I think we've had a good call here. I think we've driven some understanding of this ongoing problem of the trade deficit. I think you said China has $6 trillion built up, and that's built up by, we buy from them and they don't buy from us,
yeah,
essentially.
It's more like $3 trillion.
Okay, but it's from... We buy from them, they don't buy from us. Imagine if American companies suddenly got $3 trillion of new orders for things made and done in the United States. Imagine the economy. That's the effect on the economy of that imbalance. That's buying that Japanese car and them not buying that Jeep Cherokee that we talked about. And if you can think about the jobs involved, that's the trade deficit. So these trade deals are driving this awareness of the trade deficit. And I think we've had a pretty good discussion here of this. I want to thank Clyde, and I want to thank Dean for joining us on this call. I'm going to make a recording of this call available. We'll be writing about it, and so this call will live on with helping drive awareness of this problem. And hopefully, if we can get people to ask your members of Congress, ask your senators, and especially ask candidates this year, just ask them, say, what's the trade deficit? Do you know what it is? What are you planning to do about it? I think anything we do to drive awareness of the effect of this trade deficit will help get them to do something to fix the deficit. Now, in closing, I want to give a reminder that we have these calls regularly from Campaign for America's Future, and if you want to get on an announcement list of this, just contact me at djohnson@ourfuture.org to be on that list. And thank everybody for joining the call. Clyde, Dean, and I guess that's the end of the call. Thank you very much.
Cool. Okay. Thanks, Dave. Bye-bye.
Thank you.